Crowe. Thank you for tuning in to episode 217 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. Email me at david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com. That's Crowe with an E. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at infectiousmyth. Listen every Tuesday at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time on prn.fm or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or other programs. You can listen to any of the last five episodes over the phone by dialing the U.S. number 701-719-0990. You can also leave a voicemail for us at the prn.fm number 862-800-6805. So as well as leaving a message, make sure you leave your name and indicate that the question is for the infectious myth. And if you dial either of these numbers, remember that long-distance charges may apply. I don't know that you're a listener until I hear from you, so send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show, what you like about it, what improvements could be made. If you include your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift, which will be one of the bookmarks I make by hand using my own photographs. I do really love to hear from my listeners. Don't be shy. You can make a one-time donation to the expenses of the show via PayPal using the email david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com or monthly donations at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. And Patreon is P-A-T-R-E-O-N. We appreciate all our listeners, but if you want this show to continue to grow and improve, consider paying a small amount for the information you're gleaning, for the support you get for some non-mainstream ideas, and the challenges you get to others. The money will help pay the expenses of the show and the time that it takes me to prepare it. If you would like me to speak at a meeting of an organization you're a member of on just about any of the topics I've covered in my shows, I'd be happy to discuss this with you. I appreciate you commenting and suggesting guests. I appreciate your financial support as well. Thanks for listening and for recommending this show to your friends. It is natural if you are a parent to want to comfort your child if they're sick. If they had a fever before the 1980s, you may have very well have given them aspirin, but that advice was abandoned because of frequent occurrences of Reye syndrome, which is a very dangerous swelling of the brain and the liver. Instead, it was recommended that acetaminophen be used, most commonly known as Tylenol, but this week's guest believed that that's also dangerous. Let's go to the interview now to find out what the problems are and to discuss what else you can do with a feverish child. William Parker is an associate professor of surgery in the Surgical Sciences Faculty Lab at Duke University in Durham, North Carolina. He received a PhD from the University of Nebraska at Omaha in 1992. His research interests are transplantation, gut immunity, protein folding, and biota alteration or depletion. He has studied transplantation and organ rejection for 25 years. In the area of gut immunity, he's interested in how the microbiota responds to changing environments. I won't attempt to describe his work in protein folding, it's beyond me. But with the biota alteration or depletion theory, he's interested in how our Western culture, which presumably includes our diet and cleanliness habits, has led to immune dysfunction and disease. He's published many scientific papers as well as some articles for a wider audience, such as the 2015 paper, Intestinal Worms Can Be Good for You. But I found out about Dr. Parker when I read an article that he wrote about Tylenol. This is a summary of a literature review published in the Journal of International Medical Research in 2017 with the title, The Role of Oxidative Stress, Inflammation, and Acetaminophen Exposure from Birth to Early Childhood in the Induction of Autism. Welcome to the show, Dr. Parker.
Thank you very much, David. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yes. So concerns about Tylenol, also known as acetaminophen, don't seem to fit into your research profile. So is this a side interest or did you get to it through one of your four major areas of research?
That's a very good question. I've been asked that question once or twice, and we did come through by this naturally. So we've been working on gut function for over a decade now, and we've gravitated towards looking at intestinal worms because although intestinal worms sound horrible, you know, they're labeled as parasites by most biologists.
Right.
We probably need some intestinal worms. I mean, there's all kinds, there's good ones, there's bad ones. We but we've lost them all. We just need some of our good ones back, and that'll probably do a lot to help us have a healthier immune system. So So one of the consequences of completely missing our intestinal worms is you get more allergies, you get more autoimmunity, you get digestive disorders, and surprisingly, this is something that my lab sort of stumbled onto, and we did some nice work with Stacy Bilbo, who's director of autism research at Harvard, is you also get increased problems with neuropsychiatric disorders. So then it turns out that there's a big gut-brain connection. You know, some of your listeners may know about that. And if you're
right,
something's wrong in your gut, it can affect your brain very profoundly. But we didn't realize that it had to do with intestinal worms. And so the disorders, the neuropsychiatric disorders you can get include anxiety disorders, migraine headaches, major depressive disorder, chronic fatigue syndrome, and sort of autism. Now, when I say sort of autism, when looking at, you know, I was contacted by some folks in one of the parent organizations looking at autism and said, hey, we want you to come speak to our group. You know, we want you to look at how this relates to autism. It mm-hmm. made a lot of sense. But there was something about autism that was fishy.
Right.
If you look at the epidemiology, it really started shooting up dramatically about 1980.
Yep.
Now, if it was say just caused by loss of worms and chronic stress and inflammatory diets and some other stuff we have, it should have started shooting up way before that, and it shouldn't have gone up so dramatically after 1980. So you can look at the literature and you can see, yes, inflammation is associated with the induction of autism.
Mm-hmm.
It makes sense, you know, just because if you have something in your life that causes inflammation, it increases your risk for getting autism. So it made sense that loss of worms probably was playing a role, but if it was just the usual suspects that cause allergy, autoimmunity, other neuropsychiatric disorder, mm-hmm. we should have seen the rate of increase would look much differently.
Right. I mean, North America, especially the United States, has been obsessed with bacteria as bad things for many decades. I remember when I was a kid, and the director of my church choir, who was a young woman from the Midwestern United States, discovered that cheese was made with bacteria. She freaked out because it was just seen that bacteria, just like worms, are 100% bad things. So I think you're right. If it was our sort of cleanliness and elimination of bacteria from our lives, that occurred before the 1980s.
Right. Yeah, that really the worms especially got eliminated between about 1850 and 1950.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, you know, if you look at, for example, the appearance of hay fever in the literature, that's the late 1800s, the same for appendicitis.
Interesting.
And autoimmune diseases have been steadily increasing since the very early 1900s and probably before. None of these diseases just suddenly started skyrocketing around 1980.
Okay, well, let's do a little bit of background on Tylenol.
All right.
So it's also called acetaminophen, and it displaced older drugs like aspirin for the use of headaches and fevers, etc. Does it have any chemical relationship to aspirin, or is it something completely different?
Yeah, it's completely different than aspirin chemically. It has a completely different mechanism of action. And just to clarify and add a little more detail, so Tylenol is a trade name made by one company. It's a drug that contains acetaminophen, also known as paracetamol throughout most of the rest of the world. In America, mm-hmm. we call it acetaminophen. Everywhere else, it's paracetamol. And Tylenol is only one particular drug it's one particular brand that contains that chemical known as acetaminophen or paracetamol. There's literally hundreds of different drugs besides Tylenol, which contain acetaminophen, also known as paracetamol.
Okay, so if people are concerned, they need to go a little bit further than just the brand name Tylenol.
Absolutely, yeah. In fact, you look at a lot of medications for children have acetaminophen in them, and they've gotten better and better at, you know, putting on a warning label. But the warning just says this has acetaminophen. That way, you know, you're not, you know, if you're careful, you're not accidentally giving your kid three different drugs all containing acetaminophen.
And what are the range of ailments that Tylenol or acetaminophen are commonly used for?
Well, so what you're supposed to use it for is to treat a fever and to treat pain. Mm-hmm. Now, unfortunately, it's also being used quite a bit just to treat runny noses. And that's not really, you know, a cold, for example.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not, especially in children, that's not the idea. I mean, even the pharmaceutical industry does not recommend treating a cold in small children with acetaminophen. That's just not, you know, it's pain and fever. That's it.
Okay, pain and fever. And I think fever is pretty important, because the knee-jerk reaction of most parents is if a child has a fever, you've got to get rid of the fever.
Well, and that's true in the pediatrician's office as well. That being said, the scientific data looking at fevers shows that fevers are a part of our immune response, and they are protective.
Mm-hmm.
If you've got a quote-unquote normal fever, 102, 103 degree, and that's in Fahrenheit, I apologize.
Right. It's okay. We're bilingual up here in Canada.
Right, right. Yep, so that's good. You know, that's protective, and if you block that, you're really you're suppressing the immune system for no reason based on the available literature. Now, that being said, if you bring your kid in to the clinic, and here in the United States, you're going to have a copay that could be sizable, and they just say, hey, look, he's fine, just take him home, he'll get better. That's, you don't really like paying the money for that. But if you get some antibiotics and you get some acetaminophen, then you feel like you got your money's worth.
Somebody described the visit to the doctor as kind of like a religious ceremony, where at the end you have the communion, which is you get a piece of paper, which is your prescription. And without that, you haven't actually gone to church.
Yes, that's a very good description, yes.
And when you get Tylenol, it sounds like you may have a wide range of concentrations, so that the dose of acetaminophen, I should use that name because that's more accurate, I guess. The dose may vary depending on what medication you have. And does it also, do you have like slow release versions versus more faster acting?
Right. Well, the dose, the therapeutic dose for acetaminophen is, it's pretty consistent. Now, it's based on body weight. So it's obviously different for a tiny baby than it is an adult.
Mm.
But per weight, it really doesn't change from the time, not appreciably, from the time you're an infant to the time you're an adult. And it comes in different formulations, of course, for tiny babies. It's not a pill. It's typically a liquid.
Right, right.
Right. And then, you know, you can move up. For a lot of the children's formulations, it's a liquid. They have different flavors. You can even buy it at local toy stores in different
toy
flavors.
Stores.
The pharmacists tell me that a lot of the kids come in to the hospital and they already know what their favorite flavor of acetaminophen is.
Wow, so it's getting used a lot. Now, it seems like there's a combination of both over-the-counter and prescription.
That is correct, yes.
Okay, well, anyway, let's move on to, you know, that was all background information, but I really want to talk about your concerns about side effects, especially neurological side effects. And you've specifically mentioned ADHD and autism as potential side effects. And these are both long-term, if not permanent, effects, right? You're not talking about some kind of acute side effect that occurs after you take this pill. You're talking about something that may be with you for your life.
Yeah, so let's separate out the autism spectrum from the ADHD. We're much, I think, more confident about the autism spectrum, and it is a spectrum, but that's consistent with a chemical injury, right? You can get a spectrum, or vitamin deficiency,
right.
You can get a spectrum of disease for that too.
Right.
So, you know, any kind of these chemical interactions can, depending on the level of insult, can cause, you know, the problem. So it goes back to, we're looking at the data on the epidemiology, and something apparently happened around 1980, the children born in 1980, to really start the climb in the autism rate. Now, this is the thing that, and this is important, I think, to understand for the listener. This is the thing that clued us in that something was fishy, but this is not the best evidence that we have, right? So the epidemiology of autism is a matter of hot debate. It's probably the worst evidence you could possibly, if you're going to try to convince somebody of what's going on, this is the worst evidence, because there's so, you know, is there really an epidemic of autism? You know,
well, I interviewed a guy who's very opposed to the use of aspartame. It also was approved around 1980, right? So he was drawing graphs in his books about the use of aspartame and a bunch of diseases. But there are so many things that have been added to our life, you know, over the past few decades, new chemicals, drugs, et cetera, et cetera. It's very hard to say just because there is a correlation that this particular drug or chemical is the cause.
Right. And I agree completely. And I will give you a litany of reasons why I think that acetaminophen or paracetamol is a much better suspect than aspartame.
Yeah. And I certainly wasn't trying to bring aspartame into this particular right. discussion. So what is the evidence apart from the epidemiology of acetaminophen and autism, for example?
Right. So again, we're much more confident about the autism spectrum connection than we are about the ADHD. I'd say the ADHD, I'd classify that more as a sort of a hypothesis that we would like to look into one of these days, whereas the autism connection is so compelling that you hate to assign the word theory to it until it's very conclusively tested.
Mm-hmm.
This is extreme as a scientist. Now, as a non-scientist, the word theory and hypothesis get interchanged a lot, but you know, a theory is something you're very confident about. It's a working paradigm.
Okay. Right
now in science, because the data are very compelling. So, right, you know, the epidemiology makes sense, but it's important to understand what caused it. And if the epidemiology didn't make sense, we would throw this out. So it's important that if they had not discovered that aspirin is associated with Reye syndrome in 1982 to 84, and essentially taken it off the market for children and immediately replaced it with acetaminophen.
Okay.
Our hypothesis would be in the garbage can. So this is not the best evidence. This is not even good evidence that our hypothesis is correct, but it's sort of a check that our hypothesis does make sense.
Yeah, and it's interesting that you mentioned Reye syndrome. I was surprised when I first learned about that, but that's caused by the common aspirin. And I think it's a liver failure, isn't it, basically?
It's sort of a metabolic syndrome that it's complicated. It affects mitochondrial metabolism. And it's just a horrible, you know, it's not the same as just, I say, quote unquote, plain old liver failure. It's a systemic issue.
Right, right. So there was kind of a sudden transition. So it's not like Tylenol came on the market in 1960 and then, you know, over 20 years took over the market. This was like a recommendation. Don't use aspirin, use this instead.
Right. And Tylenol has been around. It's, you know, it's a coal tar derivative. It's came along with a handful of other drugs in the same class back in the late 1800s. And none of them that was long before the FDA. All of them except for acetaminophen have since then been eliminated from the market due to toxic side effects. Acetaminophen is the only drug in its class still standing from the 1800s, literally.
Wow.
That being said, it's been around, but it's, you know, in the 1950s, you just didn't go grab a pill every time you got sick. So the use of drugs has changed profoundly. And certainly in children, aspirin was the go-to drug in the 70s. Before the big switchover happened in the very early 1980s.
Right, right.
That being said, we think a lot of the increase through the 90s had to do with direct-to-consumer marketing, which the American Congress allowed, right? So nobody's really tracking it, and we're working on this with some information scientists, I'm collaborating with a friend of mine named Lauren Anderson, who's one of the PhDs here at Duke, trying to figure out exactly how is the change in acetaminophen use going in our society. And we think that almost all children now, upwards of 98%, are exposed to it, but nobody really knows how much we're exposed, and nobody tracked it. You know, how much were we exposed to in 1985 versus 1995 versus 2005?
Right, especially with over-the-counter drugs. I mean, a lot of them don't even get consumed. And if they do get consumed, you don't necessarily know which member of the family consumed them.
Well, yeah, except that, you know, there's special formulations for the children. So in some cases, you can tell. But
right.
You don't know if they actually consume them or not.
Yes. And you don't know if they have three children at home or just one.
Yeah. Now, that being said, there's been a nice study done, and I can't give you, we haven't published this paper yet, but one nice study was done showing about 15% of all exposures are technically overdoses, both at home and in the hospital.
Mm.
Right. Because it's just easy. It's number one, acetaminophen is so many different drugs. And number two, you know, it's easy to say, well, you know, I should be giving every 4 hours, but I want to go to bed now. So, you know, I'll just, you know, one, it's okay to give it every 2 hours, just once.
Right. Okay. Well, let's get to the evidence.
The first evidence you would think of is, well, has anybody ever looked at this in humans? And this is the first paper that I saw that jumped out at me. It's a 2008 study by Stephen Schultz. And he was at University of California at the time. Getting his PhD, and what his situation was that he was a dentist, he had a kid, the kid got vaccinated and got sick and just never recovered, regressed into autism.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so looking at the epidemiology, his conclusion was, well, it can't be the vaccine. I want to know what did this. So he quit his practice, retired from dentistry, went back and worked on his PhD looking at what causes autism. And in his thought, and he's published a little kind of a description of his journey that you can get it. I think it's free on Amazon. And he thought, well, it's probably not the vaccine based on available evidence, but what else could it be? And he thought, what if it was the acetaminophen? So he did a little study, and it was a small study, but it was statistically significant. And showed that in looking at children with autism spectrum versus children without, and looking at, did they have a reaction to a vaccine? Did they get a vaccine? And if they did they get acetaminophen? And what he found was, if they got acetaminophen and a vaccine, they had 20-fold more regressive autism. 20-fold, it's not 20%.
Mm-hmm.
20-fold more regressive autism than if they just got a vaccine. Now, this 20-fold number, that's what we're looking for. We're looking for the difference between now and in 1970. And that is 20 to 40-fold. That's a big difference.
So, right, and that's a huge signal, because often, you know, it's not very often you get a signal that big.
Nope. You got that right.
I mean, it's interesting. So it could be something, a combination of the vaccine and the acetaminophen, or it could just be that the vaccine caused the fever, which caused the acetaminophen to be used.
Right. So that being said, right. So you're onto something there. And if you read our paper that's in the Journal of International Medical Research with Stacy, who's again the director of autism research at Harvard right now. What you'll see is, it's clear it's not just acetaminophen. I mean, most kids that get acetaminophen are perfectly fine. And that's very important to point out, right? Or because we know that virtually everybody, because almost everybody's getting acetaminophen,
mm-hmm.
most people do not have autism spectrum disorder.
Right.
So there is a second variable, and that one is what's called oxidative stress. And that's when your body just can't keep up with the amount of inflammation you've got going on. And in general, that's a good, I think, way to describe the general cause of oxidative stress, or the general state of oxidative stress,
mm-hmm.
right? And it can be caused by other things. It can be caused by a genetic mutation. It can be caused by exposure to toxins.
Mm-hmm.
But then that will eventually lead to inflammation. But the bottom line is you need these two components. You need, and of course, if the kid's super sick, his immune system is going to be stressed, and it's usually a male. And we can talk about that. That's another indicator.
Yeah, I definitely want to talk about gender.
Yeah, let's go into that in a minute. But for now, you've got a boy. He's got a lot of stress from being sick. And then, you know, they take him to the doctor. He's way behind on his vaccines. He gets a flood of vaccines. Unfortunately, you're not supposed to do that, but sometimes it happens. And then they give him acetaminophen to boot and probably some antibiotics. So the antibiotics likely also induce some oxidative stress. So you've got a storm there, perfect storm of oxidative stress plus acetaminophen. And the way that drug is metabolized in the presence of oxidative stress is completely different than the way that a healthy person metabolizes it.
Okay.
And we know that drug breaks down into a toxic metabolite. And this happens in adults who are drinking alcohol and taking acetaminophen. That's why you never mix alcohol and acetaminophen, because it causes the alcohol induces a kind of change in the way that you handle chemicals. And then the acetaminophen gets processed into you can think of it as a mercury-like compound. It behaves like the toxin mercury in many regards. It's called NAPQI. It's naphthoquinone. It's known exactly how it works, and it's just extremely toxic. Then that's when you get in trouble.
And you think this can be happening in children who are obviously not likely to be taking alcohol, but whose body is under stress, maybe because of infection, because of recent vaccination, because of antibiotics?
Yeah, so it could be. I mean, if you look at the laundry list of things that are associated with autism, and the list is very large, every single one of them is associated with inflammation and or oxidative stress.
Hmm. And you said earlier that the dosage is basically the same per body weight. Do you have evidence that children, you know, by body weight are less capable of processing acetaminophen than say an adult, you know, per pound, per kilo?
Well, let's put it this way. So the children do process things differently than adults do.
Mm-hmm.
But they still are capable of processing things the safe way. Now, the big difference, I think, based on available evidence, and there's good evidence for this, we haven't talked yet about, well, what happens if you give a baby laboratory animal some acetaminophen? And we'll come to that.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The bottom line is that in adults, if you have a lot of oxidative stress and you get acetaminophen, it will destroy your liver.
Mm-hmm.
So unfortunately, and we haven't published this paper yet, we're working on this. So I'm just going to say hypothetically what we think is, and we're going to dig into this deeper and see if we can get a paper published on it. Everyone assumed that since acetaminophen is toxic to the adult liver, if we're going to look at safety in children, we only need to check the liver.
And not the brain.
Now, this is a huge, huge assumption because, number one, in babies, the brain is still developing, so it's known to be more sensitive, right? And that's number one. And then number two, the liver is a lot different. It's pretty rubbery in babies. It doesn't metabolize the drug very fast because it's only really meant for exposure to breast milk. So it's the drug metabolism is just different in babies fundamentally. Now, the pathways by which acetaminophen is broken down are very similar and related. There are fundamental differences. There's, you know, there's no point going into the biochemistry.
Mm-hmm.
It's related, and you can still get the toxic metabolite production in a baby.
Okay. Well, let's go to the animal model, because it's very hard to get good data. Like you can hardly dose a bunch of babies with high doses of acetaminophen just to see if it causes brain damage. That probably would not be an ethical experiment.
Well, let's talk about that. So if we really want to do an experiment in humans, it would be cheap because you can block oxidative stress of acetaminophen easily with simple amino acid derivative. You can buy it in the store. It's not formulated for children. You need to get IRB, you need to get ethics board approval to do that, but it would be a simple experiment to do. You know, you wouldn't have to give up the acetaminophen. You could, I think we need to educate people about, you know, these acetaminophen is, it's a mind altering drug, right? It's intended to shut down pain reception. It's to shut down the hypothalamus, which is, you know, the part of the brain that produces fever.
Mm-hmm.
Why, you know, we don't just need, the drugs are not safe. They're just not. The question is, are we better off with or without the drug? So, you know, that's the question we have to ask. We don't just, you don't just throw a drug at something willy-nilly. And I think our society may have lost track of that, right? The drug, using a drug is a significant, it's a significant decision that needs to be made based on the pros and the cons of using the drug, not just because, you know, just to be safe, let's just use a drug. It doesn't work that way.
That, I think that's the common belief amongst a lot of parents and a lot of MDs.
And it has a lot to do with marketing, direct-to-consumer marketing. Yeah. I mean, they're not allowed to say you give the drug and you get a happy baby, but the picture's worth a thousand words.
Right.
And the U.S. government doesn't block drug companies from conveying things through images, which are much more powerful than the words that would be illegal for them to use.
Right. The most advanced science in America, I think, is marketing.
Right. So that being said, to your question, there's all kinds of studies we could do in humans if somebody was interested, right? Well, education, reduction of acetaminophen use. We could put in the, you know, we could just block the toxic metabolism by using N-acetylcysteine or NAC, it's called. Uh-huh. It's very non-toxic. It's easy to use. It does taste horrible, so that's an issue with babies. They to work their way around that, but that shouldn't be too hard because there's other ways to deliver that.
Right.
But bottom line is, at least in the United States, nobody's really working on this that we know of. And I hope that, you know, what we're hoping, we're trying to raise awareness. If this gets to the right person, you know, there's plenty of people that think it's a vaccine, and they've raised awareness, and we want to raise awareness about the acetaminophen issue, and especially, you know, the idea that co-administration of acetaminophen, and this is the Schultz study that I mentioned earlier in 2008, if you take away the acetaminophen in that study, the kids are safe. They're 20-fold safer than if you have the acetaminophen there.
Mm-hmm.
Acetaminophen appears to be the key ingredient. So that being said, let's go to the animal studies.
Yeah.
Eventually, they did give, and a couple of different labs have done this, one in Europe, and maybe they're both in Europe. The references are in that paper. They've done it in mice and in rats. And if you take a baby mouse, or it's called a pup, or a baby rat, and you give them just a regular dose of acetaminophen, it's not like these studies where you give them 100 times what a human gets.
Right.
The same dose a human gets, they will get permanent neurological dysfunction.
Really?
Yes, really.
And this is per the body weight of the mouse. So this is a tiny amount of acetaminophen, right? Because the mice is...
It's tiny for us, but it's the normal amount you would think that a mouse should get, right?
Right, but you're not giving a child's dose to a mouse. You're giving a mouse dose to a mouse. Right.
Yeah, it's proportionate to the weight of the organism, yeah.
And that still causes a significant neurological defects in all mice?
I think, if I'm not mistaken, it mostly affects males.
Interesting. That's the next.
So the chair of pharmacology, Peg McCarthy, that's what she works on, is, you know, how these types of drugs affect the brain. And her studies say the chair of pharmacology at a major institution, you know, these folks are not, you know, and like I said, Stacey Bilbo has been working with us. This is not a bunch of minor league players that are saying this. And the Schultz study was done out of the University of California. You know, it's hard in a way for us because, you know, we're not the John the Baptist type, you know, out in with the long beards, although I do have a long beard, but I'm not, you know, out in the wilderness, you know, screaming, you know, these are mainstream investigators.
Mm-hmm.
You know, look at this information, and it's clear based on these studies in rodents that if it was a modern drug, it would never have been put into the first child because it causes permanent neurological dysfunction in laboratory animals.
And this is well over a century after the drug was first brought into use.
Yeah, but you can see how it slipped by, because the people that were taking it, you know, they have fevers, and fevers are known to have their own problems a lot, or they were really sick. So, and this is what happened, we think, with the vaccine issue, is people just thought it was the vaccine and never would suspect that this nice, friendly drug, you know, was the real culprit behind the scene.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, you're essentially saying that there is some synergy, because the vaccine changes your immune system. Even if it doesn't have any toxic effect, the vaccine will cause a fever. I mean, if it didn't cause the fever, you probably wouldn't use acetaminophen.
No, that's not correct. I mean, they were giving the acetaminophen prophylactically.
Oh, really? So you have a vaccine, they give it to you regardless of what happens.
Yeah. Or, you know, if you came in, you were sick, you would get it. Like I said, if you take away the acetaminophen, so the question is, let's say you just got sick without a vaccine at all, and then you got the acetaminophen. You know, that study, that would be a very, very difficult, and the ethics of that one would be really messy to try to sort out exactly what is causing the oxidative stress. But again, we can just block that. That's easy peasy to block that. So we don't really have to worry. If we were doing studies in humans, let's just start with, let's block the oxidative stress. Don't start with trying to sort out, is it factor A or factor B or factor C? And as I said, there's dozens of different factors that cause oxidative stress. The only reason we're curious about the vaccine is because that one has been associated in the minds of many parents with autism induction.
Yes. And also autism, as we've alluded to this earlier, is very much a male thing, much higher rate amongst boys.
Right.
And so you have evidence, like you said, there's animal evidence that it's worse in males. Do you have...
Right, and let me just be clear, it's not from my lab. These are the folks that are working with acetaminophen in laboratory animals.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Is there other evidence that acetaminophen has is more likely to produce adverse reactions in boys, apart from the animal research? That's okay. Well, if you don't have anything.
If it works in the animal models and it's so specific for the males, then it's more or less an open and shut case there, because the only thing you can get that's better than an animal model is an actual study in humans. So this is where my brain is going when you ask this question. Like, well, what did because the only real work that's been done in human, now there's a lot of work done in pregnancy, and pregnancy is a different ballgame. We can talk about that if you want, but it's only a 15% increase in autism with heavy use of acetaminophen during pregnancy, which is 15% with heavy use. That's nothing to write home about. It means, well,
right.
You know, cause not that many women use it heavily during pregnancy, number one, and 15% is nowhere near 20 fold. So we're really more, I think the mother's liver processes it during pregnancy, and that's why you don't have to worry about it.
Right. I mean, it's interesting. I grew up in the post-thalidomide era, so it was understood by everybody that pregnant women shouldn't take any drugs, and it seems like we've slipped backwards a lot, and now it's routine to take drugs during pregnancy, and there doesn't seem to be much concern about it. But even a 15% risk, like if you were to go to a woman and say, you know, you've got a fever, we can give you Tylenol to resolve your fever, but if you take a bunch of Tylenol during your pregnancy, there's a 15% increased risk of autism and maybe other things.
Let's talk about that. So probably taking Tylenol for fevers during pregnancy is maybe beneficial, maybe not beneficial. Data are not clear. The heavy users of acetaminophen during pregnancy are not taking it for fever, because fevers don't last that long. They're taking it for pain.
Okay.
Yes, that's a very important distinction. So, and we know that fevers are a risk factor for autism.
Right? Fevers during pregnancy.
Right. So you don't know. Yeah, a lot of things during pregnancy, such as infections that you might take acetaminophen for, are risk factors. So very few studies have tried to separate out. I mean, and plus the type of autism that gets induced, although it's not much, but the type that gets induced by acetaminophen during pregnancy is a different type that gets induced, say, as soon as the umbilical cord is cut. So we know, for example, boys with a circumcision have 54% more autism, maybe a little more, than boys that are uncircumcised.
That was interesting.
Yeah, it's very interesting. It's not due to the circumcision because it doesn't affect, say, Muslim children and traditional Muslim communities.
Right.
The only reasonable explanation, and you could come up with another one, but the Occam's razor, you know, the simplest explanation makes sense. Should go with that unless there's compelling reason otherwise. It's is that you're, you know, using acetaminophen in conjunction with a circumcision.
Right, right. That definitely right. makes
that's
sense.
A different type of autism than you get with use that's associated with use heavy use during pregnancy.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the doctors and I guess the parents, but let's go to the MDs. Like, is it true that almost all believe that Tylenol is safe without long-term side effects?
Most of the, I mean, it's not their job to be aware of the current literature. That's the bottom line. Unless, you know, I can't tell you the number of, you know, my wife and I joke, it's always a great day when you're not attacked by a pediatrician. Yeah, and it's, the bottom line is it's not their job to know the current literature because there's millions, literally, these papers published each year. It's their job to implement standard of care. Right. Okay. Now, standard of care is to give the kid the acetaminophen.
And so that's that implies two things. First is that the acetaminophen is given, say, for a fever that you're saying might not be necessary. And then secondly, you know, a lack of belief that it has side effects. So you're right, that somebody should be telling, if it's decided that acetaminophen is a problem, then some organization should tell the MDs that standard of care has changed. And now we don't recommend Tylenol, just like we don't recommend aspirin for children.
Right. And exactly. It's the pediatricians depend on, you know, the Academy of Pediatrics and the FDA to tell them this is your standard of care. And that's their job. Their job is not to sit around and say, well, you know, I think we should do something differently. You know, then anarchy would reign in the field of medicine. You know, that's not what a medical doctor is supposed to be doing.
I think most average people think that MDs are up to date with the medical literature, but just from the number of publications, that would be impossible.
It's physically can't be done.
Yes. I mean, you couldn't be a practicing doctor if you read everything with every condition that you're, say you're a pediatrician, every condition that your children might experience. If you kept up to date with the literature, it would be more than a 7-day a week job just for that.
Oh yeah. I think it would be, you know, you would need probably hundreds of hours in each day, number one. And number two, with some things it's not clear. For example, if you're the average pediatrician, you want to know, is there an actual epidemic of autism spectrum disorder? You can't tell from looking in the literature. The literature's all jumbled up, right?
Right, right. Well, hopefully your papers start some kind of a discussion, and it sounds like you have more plans to do
further research. Well, we're doing additional papers, and again, we try not to rely on the epidemiology at all. It's except as a check that it matches what we think the epidemiology might be, and that's all we're going to say about that. But hey, let's look at the Schultz study. Let's look at circumcision. Let's look at the studies in the animal models. You know, let's look at, say, the current epidemiology in Israel, which is otherwise unexplained to this date. You know, why should the modern Jews have so much more autism than the traditional Jews? And the Israeli government says, you know, it's not socioeconomic. It's not geographic. It's got to be something with the religion, which seems insane until... Right. You realize, oh, okay, they have different practices with circumcision.
So the Orthodox Jews do not give drugs after circumcision.
Well, they give wine.
Oh, well, yeah.
And it doesn't cause autism.
Right. Interesting. That's just fascinating that there would be that difference, because it's very easy to jump to conclusions. And obviously, the type of circumcision is pretty hard to see how the way it's cut would cause autism in some children and a different way of cutting wouldn't.
Right. Well, you can come up with some kind of really complicated theory of how that might work. But again, as you look at, and people ask me, well, it could be this, it could be that. And the bottom line is, I say, well, okay, you've explained, although it's complicated, it's maybe feasible. You've explained this one particular bit of data, but then how do you explain this other, how do you explain the studies in the laboratory animals? They say, well, that's a different model. Oh, okay, how do you explain the Schultz study? And then when you ask about the Schultz study, the only response to that is, well, it's a small study. So maybe it's not, entirely reliable. And my response to that would be, look, it's the only study and it shows a 20-fold difference. So there is no reason to ignore that study.
And so for a parent, for a new parent, their child is likely to experience fevers and other things to which you might prescribe Tylenol in the future. But if we just talk about the fevers, just not giving anti-fever medication might be the safest thing. If the fever isn't getting out of control, I think you said 102 at the upper limit.
No, it's maybe 103. But now, yeah. Hear me out. Now, if you go say don't treat a fever, you're liable should somebody not treat a fever. So you can't say don't treat a fever. You can say educate yourself, and you have to make decisions. Number one. Number two, I would say the American Academy of Pediatrics has a great website on how to treat a fever without drugs. Some people are literally allergic to acetaminophen; they just can't take any dose.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, if there's lots of ways to treat a fever, and jumping in ice water is not one of them.
Right. I was talking about the parents. Like, obviously, an MD's got to follow, unfortunately, got to follow the standard of care. Well, I guess for better or for worse.
I'm talking about the parent. You can look it up on the web. It'll tell the parent, dress them in cool clothes. You can let them go, say, not in a cold swimming pool, but, you and I would like to go swimming in water that's, 80 degrees. That would be nice. 70 degrees, not so comfortable. Right. And so it's the same with the little kid, right? But 80 degrees cools the body down.
Mm, yes. Cause the body is,
the body's at 97, right? Or
right.
Over 100, even 90 degree water.
Right.
Going to cool the body down. So, cause water conducts heat extremely well.
Right. But I guess what I'm saying is before we discover, under what circumstances acetaminophen could be used safely, or what alternatives could be used, or what sort of additional thing that you could give to make it safer, maybe the safest thing is to not take it unless you really need it, not to give it unless it's really necessary.
Well, of course, then you ask the question, well, when is it really necessary? And then you have to be very careful, because you can't, if you're not the physician looking at the child, you can't make that recommendation. And again, I would say there's a lot of options. You don't use a mind-altering drug literally as first line of defense. There's so many other ways. If you're a parent, there's so many other things to do first.
And, yes.
And speaking of mind-altering, just another one of these little smoking guns is, in adults, acetaminophen is known to blunt social awareness.
Interesting. What do you mean by blunting social awareness?
I mean, you literally, if you're given tests about, awareness of, say, social outrage or these problems with social situations, your awareness as an adult temporarily decreases. So we know that in adults, at least temporarily, not permanently, but temporarily, while the drug is in the system, it's affecting the social awareness of the adult. And of course, that's the hallmark of the autism spectrum, is that your social awareness is blunted.
And is this a permanent effect or just temporarily after
you? In adults, it's just temporary.
Right. So I guess that's two reasons not to go to a cocktail party on Tylenol. is first, you might say something you regret. And secondly, you might be tempted to drink alcohol.
That's a very, so nobody's ever gotten that one before. That's very good, David. I'm going to have to remember that one. Yep.
Yes. Okay. Well, we're getting towards the end of of our discussion, or the time that we have allotted for this discussion. So did we miss anything? I have one more question, and then I'll let you finish too. You quoted a paper by a guy named DeFaze. He studied the drug, admitted that there were problems, and then said it was still safe, I believe, in pregnant women, which seemed kind of bizarre when there's a lot of open questions. Do you want to comment on that paper or study?
Well, I think, so as you see the evolution of the literature on this topic, and it's really exploded in the last 5 years, mostly, all of the papers, except for the original Schultz paper, have been done on pregnant women. And it's easy, it's for a lot of reasons, it's easier to look at that issue than it is to look at exposure to babies and children. So as things evolve, you know, you read some of the initial papers that came out 2010, 2011, they're saying, hey, it looks like the signal is real. We can't explain it any other way. You know, there is some kind of effect, but you know, this control hasn't been run. You know, we can't really be sure 100% if it is, you know, maybe something associated with the acetaminophen. But then, you know, the next year, another paper, and so they'll say, but we're not sure. So, you know, we should not panic. And there's a lot of that idea that you see, even when, you know, when I read people writing, there was a good study that came out from Spain. And within, you know, they spent a long time looking at that study. They controlled for a lot of things. They controlled, it was a nicely done study, one of the more recent studies. And the National Health Service of the UK and the, unfortunately, National Institutes of Health in the United States just copied it over. But the National Health Service in the UK immediately, within hours, came out with a rebuttal saying, look, they didn't control for this, they didn't control for that, so don't panic.
Yeah. I mean, that seems like the opposite of the precautionary principle, right? We're going to conservatively.
So you've got to understand the modern mentality that the drug is safe and the drugs are the only thing that can save us.
Yes, yes.
That's the modern mentality. And we see that when we're working with our intestinal worms. You know, hey, this is a general anti-inflammatory. It works for a lot of things. And it works so well because it's addressing a fundamental cause of disease. So from when I talk to a biologist, there's a 100% uptake. It's the only reasonable explanation that anybody has that I know of for why we have so much of these allergies and autoimmunity. Mm. But when you talk to a clinician about this, it really sounds too good to be true. It sounds like I'm a snake oil salesman. And I have no conflict of interest. I'm not going to get to the end of the conversation and say, subscribe to my...
You haven't patented any worms.
We Duke has patents on stuff, but because I'm doing human subjects research, I can never, and it's irrevocable, I can never make a penny on this. But we have to get the patents so we can try to move it forward and commercialize it, even though, again, I have no conflict of interest financially. It's nobody in my family either can make a penny on worms. Anyway, but I have to disclose, yes, we have patents, we have companies.
Correct.
I'm not allowed to profit from them because we are really working on trying to get worms available. But the bottom line is we run into the same mentality of if you don't have a drug, you're just not safe. And you know, a lot of that could be from the antibiotic era where, wow, those drugs really just were a magic bullet and saved so many lives.
Right.
We went overboard, it seems.
Yes. Yeah, I think definitely we sort of assumed this because some drugs were very good under a lot of circumstances that all drugs under all circumstances are good. So to wrap up, do you want to add anything to what has been a really interesting discussion?
No, I think it was very interesting. I enjoyed talking with you very much. I think we covered most of the bases, you know, the general information about why we think acetaminophen, you know, is inducing so much of the autism spectrum disorder.
Yeah, well, I think you've made a good case. And for people who are interested in learning more, I'm going to include a link to the popular article that I first encountered, and also a link to the academic or article in the Journal of International Medical Research, which is freely available. So I'll just include a link to that.
Yeah, maybe we published several different popular articles. And one of them in particular is, you know, why are physicians still adamant that it's safe? Why does the National Health Service say that it's safe? You know, when in fact you can tell by looking at their report, right? They're stretched very thin. Some person had to write the report. They only had a couple of days to write it. They didn't, you know, it took us 8 months and two interns to put that paper together and really dig deep in the information. And they took, you know, 48 hours.
Yes.
You know, it's like, come on. And they obviously didn't even read the paper they were reviewing. So yeah, it's, there's a lot of popular information that we put out there to try to explain what's going on. And, you know, I get occasionally somebody will say, well, there's so many safety studies. How are you ignoring those? And we have done a good job of looking through the literature. There are a lot of safety studies, and especially in animal models, and they all show it is dangerous, period.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for sharing this important information with me today.
It's my pleasure. You're very welcome.
Okay. Have a good evening. Goodbye.
All right, thank you, sir. You too. Bye-bye.
After thinking about this interview, I don't see why the theory that vaccines can cause neurological damage is incompatible with the theory that combating fever with acetaminophen can cause similar damage. At the very least, according to the acetaminophen theory, the vaccine places the child in a state where they are vulnerable to damage from the drug. There's not enough attention to either of these potential causes, largely the fault of the media that has been intimidated by so-called public health officials who are really just helping promote universal vaccination by suppressing any discussion of adverse consequences of vaccines. I'm sure that most of them are sincere, but it's not plausible that every vaccine added to the schedule is A, safe, B, effective, and C, necessary. That's certainly not true of ingested pharmaceutical drugs. Why would anyone think it would be true of injected vaccines? Thank you for listening to episode 217 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. Like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at infectiousmyth. Commit to monthly donations of any amount at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. Until next week, thank you and goodbye.